I will begin by introducing Laura A. Athens, an attorney, mediator, and arbitrator in Farmington Hills, Michigan. Her practice is focused primarily on education law and disability rights, providing legal representation and neutral alternative dispute resolution services in aid and educational matters. Laura has served as a hearing officer in special ed due process hearings and in vocational rehab matters. She continues to mediate special and general education, vocational rehabilitation, guardianship, and disability rights cases, as well as, of course, bullying. As an adjunct professor at Wayne State University Law School, Laura has taught education law, health law, and bioethics, as well as other topics at Washington University School of Law. She is associated with Professional Resolution Experts of Michigan, or PREMI, has served on the State Bar of Michigan's Alternative Dispute Resolution Section Council, where I first met Laura, former chair of the Oakland County Bar Association's ADR Committee, and has published numerous articles on education law and ADR issues, frequently speaking on school-related topics. Laura will be interviewed by Zena Zumeta, a nationally known mediator and mediation trainer from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Zena has also served on the ADR Section Council and served with Laura and I before graduating to go on and do other things. So without further ado, I will turn it over to Zena and Laura. And again, your phones will be muted and we will allow questions and answers near the end. Thank you and take it away.
Oh, thanks so much, Bob. So, Laura, do you want to introduce it just by talking about what the topic is, and then I'll ask you some more detailed questions?
Sure. Thanks, Zena. The participants should have an outline of our agenda. Basically, we're going to initially talk about the different types of bullying. I'm going to briefly mention some statistics, and then we'll go on to talk about characteristics that are associated with bullies, as well as characteristics associated with the targets of bullying and risk factors. Some warning signs that parents and school personnel and others can look for when they're suspecting bullying. We'll discuss a little bit about the negative effects of bullying. And after that, we'll be getting into more of the dispute resolution options. We will talk about the various kinds of options under ADR that are available to address bullying and harassment. And in that context, we'll talk a little bit about educational options as well. And then we'll move on to talking about the Michigan anti-bullying law. A little bit about the Michigan policy, anti-bullying policy, and then a little bit about federal civil rights statutes that are relevant to bullying and harassment. And we'll also touch on some U.S. Supreme Court precedent regarding disability, race, religion, all kinds of different harassment or bullying. And in the end, we have some case examples that we'd like to present, time permitting, and I definitely would like to have participation of the audience members, many of whom are very talented and experienced in a variety of areas that relate to this topic.
And so the last part will be Q&A and discussion. So why don't we start, Laura, if you would just start by talking about what bullying is, some of the definitions, some of the types.
Sure. And most of the statutes and policies contain a definition of bullying, but essentially bullying encompasses a variety of intentional, aggressive, intimidating, or antisocial behaviors. And these can be physical, verbal, or written. To kind of break it down and talk about each of the different types, I'd like to just take a couple minutes and talk about what they might look like. For example, the verbal. The verbal can encompass teasing, name-calling, insulting, threatening, making derogatory comments regarding protected characteristics like disability, gender, race, ethnicity, religion. It can also encompass verbal abuse regarding sexual orientation, gender identity, or other characteristics. So that's the verbal piece of it. Physical aggression, as you can imagine, can encompass all kinds of behaviors, hitting, kicking, punching, shoving, choking. There are times where students are, you know, tripped on the stairway or tripped in the cafeteria, shoved into lockers, thrown into garbage cans, all kinds of different things that can occur in terms of physical aggression. Sexual harassment can encompass rape, sexual assault, sexual coercion. Sexual harassment might include things like sexual comments with innuendos or sexual rumors, gestures, non-consensual touching of a sexual nature, sexually explicit drawings, name-calling. Something that is particularly damaging has become much more widespread is cyber or virtual bullying. And cyber or virtual bullying is defined as using electronic media to send or distribute insulting or demeaning messages or photos. And it can have a particularly devastating effect because, first of all, there's a broader reach. It's more permanent. It can be accessed 24/7. A student who, you know, uses virtual bullying can remain anonymous, and because it's not face-to-face and they're sort of hidden behind the technology, then it can become particularly vicious. And there's also really no escape from it. It's there. I mean, you can turn off your computer, you can turn off your phone, but it's something that people use every day. There's other situations where they invite others to join in, so they might be making some derogatory comments on the Facebook page, and others are chiming in and agreeing. And if it is anonymous, then a student that goes to school and doesn't know who it is constantly looking over their shoulder and not knowing who they should be concerned about and who is not a threat.
Wow. So it sounds like that made things much worse. Yep.
Absolutely, and it's a little more difficult to police. And in terms of the school responding, there has to be some nexus to the school and some disruption of the school environment. And oftentimes it does trickle into the school environment and so that they can take steps to address it. An extreme example of cyberbullying occurred in September 2010. There was a Rutgers University freshman male who was gay, and his roommate secretly videotaped him kissing another male and then posted it on the internet. And as a result of that, the student was so humiliated that he committed suicide by jumping off the George Washington Bridge.
I remember that. Yeah.
So there's some really sad situations, and the case continues to be pretty controversial because the roommate, who had 15 criminal charges filed against him, was convicted on several counts, including bias, intimidation, and invasion of privacy, and the judge could have sentenced him up to 10 years. And he also could have been deported on the basis of the conviction because he was from a foreign country. Instead, he was sentenced to only 30 days in jail and got out after 20 for good behavior. In that case, to my knowledge, it's still on appeal. Both sides appealed. You know, the prosecution appealed because of the lenient sentence, and the individual appealed, arguing that the hate crime that he was charged with was unconstitutional.
Well, can you talk a little bit about the extent of bullying? How much is out there, and what are the statistics? What do they look like?
Sure, and I'd like to move on to statistics in just a minute, but I want to just briefly touch on a couple other manifestations of bullying quickly.
Sorry. Okay.
Social includes things like gossiping and spreading rumors and shunning and ostracizing and excluding. This type of bullying tends to be more common among females. Another type of bullying is dares or hazing. And finally, demanding property, demanding money or services. So they might say, you know, turn over your cell phone, give me your iPad, I want that piece of jewelry, take it off now. The services might be, you got to do my homework, you need to run some errands for me. So there's so many different manifestations and types of bullying that can occur.
Right. So on to the statistics.
The statistics are, first of all, the statistics, I think, are really understated, only because much of the behavior occurs under the radar of adults. So a lot of it is not even noticed, and some of it is not reported because of students, concern about retaliation or embarrassment or just not wanting to be a tattletale. But one study has estimated that 81% of aggressive incidents are never reported. So any statistics that we might have about the incidents are, underreported, because of the underreporting would be appear to be less than is actually occurring. Does that make sense, Sina?
and by quite a bit, so that's kind of scary.
Yes. But when you go on and look at some of the national surveys of the incidents, they estimate that 30% of students have either been a perpetrator or victim of bullying. And there is the United States Department of Health and Human Services report that is similar. It says 15 to 20% of students have been bullied at some time, and 15 to 20% admit to bullying others with some frequency.
Oh.
And again, that's admission, and how many people admit that they're a bully. So I think it definitely is an underestimate. There's also some statistics related to bullicide, which is a term used for people who commit suicide as a result of bullying. And a very recent JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association Pediatrics study, indicated that victims of bullying are 2.5 times more likely to commit suicide than those who are not bullied.
Wow.
Yeah, and another study that is even more striking, a study specifically surveying gay bullying, found that 9 out of 10 gay students have been bullied, and they are 4 times more likely to attempt suicide than heterosexual students.
Very sobering statistics. Well, can you talk a little bit about characteristics both of the bullies and the targets?
Sure. The sort of stereotypical view of what a bully is oftentimes is true. It's somebody with an antisocial personality, somebody unable to feel empathy, maybe has some kind of personality disorder, no moral compass. But sometimes, and then there's some that are, skilled manipulators. They appear sweet, in front of adults, but then, lie and inflict emotional pain when others are not looking. But sometimes it's a very popular student, kind of the mean girls thing, somebody who wants to decide who's in and who's not. They can end up being like the leader of the pack, being aggressive and condescending and urging others to do that as well.
So that's kind of very broad, everything from people who are in the middle of a social group to people who are quite antisocial or maybe even sociopathic.
Yeah, you're right, to the fringes. And ironically, those who have, and maybe it's not so ironic, psychologists can explain this, but those who have been a victim of bullying, either at home or at school or elsewhere, are more likely to bully others, the learned behavior sometimes.
Okay. So how about the victims? What do they look like?
You know, there's a number of risk factors associated with being a target. Sometimes it's some atypical physical characteristics. They may be extremely short or very tall, or, you know, they may be obese. Obese. They may be obese. They may have acne. They may have large or unusual facial features. Sometimes, typically, you know, at the middle school age where students are changing, you know, there can be intolerance for, you know, differences and diversity. So that's one aspect of a risk factor. Students with disabilities are significantly more likely to be bullied. First of all, they're more vulnerable. And sometimes they don't even know they're being bullied when they're being bullied. So, and then if they get a clue about it, sometimes they're have difficulty reporting it, or when they do report it, because of maybe some communication or social deficits, they're not really taken as seriously because they have difficulty describing sometimes what occurred. Anyone who's perceived as weak or anxious or introverted may be more likely to be bullied. Loners who don't have friends are really susceptible to coercion and manipulation because they desperately want friends. Those, you know, who whose sexual orientation, a gay, lesbian, trans, sexual, either perceived or actual, so it may or may not, they may or may not be gay, but if they are perceived as gay, they may be bullied. The gender identity, how a student might act or dress or speak. And then there's obviously, you know, bullying based upon religion, cultural beliefs, race, ethnicity. And sometimes they're bullied because they're exceptionally good at what they do, and there's a resentment or jealousy. So it's possible for students who are, you know, excel in sports or are academically gifted or popular to also be targets of bullying. So again, you kind of run the full spectrum.
It really does. Yeah. Well, is there a way to figure out that someone is being bullied? Are there warning signs? Are there things that people should look for?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, sometimes it takes a cumulative effect for it really to be recognized. But some of the things that parents and school personnel and other interested adults should look for are unexplained bruises or cuts or other injuries, especially if they're frequent, sadness, difficulty sleeping, sometimes unprovoked emotional outbursts, loss of appetite, refusal or avoidance of school generally or specific school events. I mean, if the student has been targeted at certain after-school extracurricular activities, they may want to avoid those clubs or sporting mm-hmm. events. You know, withdrawal from family and friends and favorite activities. Sometimes it manifests as somatic complaints, headaches, stomach aches, other physical kind of ailments without any kind of medical cause. They may express or act on a desire to run away if they're feeling particularly desperate. They may carry a weapon to school for protection. And, you know, most of the time that's not discovered until it's discovered at school.
Yeah.
I mean, typically a parent doesn't find out about that, but until they get a call from the principal or administrator. And then some other things are torn or damaged clothing, missing or damaged school supplies. Those are some of the warning signs that a student or child might be a victim of bullying.
And, of course, those are symptoms of many other things as well. So,
absolutely.
Then it has to be followed up on. So
it can be missed. Like I said, sometimes you need to see a number of things to start thinking, wait a minute, something's
right.
Not right here.
Right. That makes sense. And a lot of those symptoms are things that are typical of middle school anyway, so
right.
That makes it harder.
Yeah.
So if you look at the effects of bullying, aside from the physical bullying itself, what are they?
Mm-hmm. Well, it can be extremely devastating to the student's self-esteem. It can lead to feelings of guilt and shame and loneliness and depression. It can also result in school avoidance and academic failure. It can lead to suicidal ideation,
right.
Behavior, or actual suicide, like we talked about.
Right.
It can lead to other self-injurious behaviors where there's the cutting behavior or other self-injurious head-banging, you know, all kinds of different self-injurious behaviors. And it may actually trigger violent behavior toward others, you know, including younger siblings.
Wow. So thank you for the descriptions and the definitions. Can we move on to look at what are some of the dispute resolution options and how dispute resolution could help?
Sure. I think that's a great idea, Zena. Maybe just to begin, I'll talk generally about some of the dispute resolution options that are applied to the bullying situation, and then we can get a little more specific. Does that make sense?
Great. Yep. Great.
Initially, you know, parents or school personnel may suggest a meeting. And typically it's administration, the principal or assistant principal, that becomes involved. Assistant principal is typically responsible for investigating anything that might require discipline, suspension, or other kinds of discipline. So there may be a meeting with school staff. There may be a facilitated meeting where the school social worker, counselor, or psychologist becomes involved. With a special education student, there may be a facilitated IEP meeting, IEP being the Individualized Education Program. And so if there is a student that happens to have a disability who has been persistently bullied and harassed, then sometimes you need to look at whether there needs to be additional services or different programs or supports to help the student that's been the target of bullying. And so an individual can be a facilitator of that process. Peer mediation is used, and we're going to talk more about mediation and some case examples of how mediation is used. Peer mediation is sometimes suggested. And I do have some concerns about the use of peer mediation in a situation where a student has been bullied.
I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, and I'm sure, Zena, with all of your experience in the family law context and workplace, you have some thoughts about use of peer mediation when there's intimidation or bullying.
Right. And what are your concerns with peer mediation?
Yeah, and here we are. I mean, we, you know, when you're talking about family law and when you're talking about workplace or employment law, those are adults, and these are children. And so
right. When
you encourage peer mediation, or sometimes it's let's make friends with the person who's been harassing or bullying you, it's really inappropriate. It's analogous to the use of peer mediation or, you know, straight, you know, face-to-face mediation in domestic violence or child abuse or workplace bullying. And in many times it's just inappropriate because of the fear and intimidation, the imbalance of power and the potential for abuse.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Can I go back and ask a question about, you had talked about meetings with school staff. Would those include the parents or would those include the student?
It could include both. The meetings can include the students individually, the perpetrator and the target, and any student witnesses. It can include meetings with the parent and target of bullying, the parent and perpetrator of bullying, and sometimes there are even joint sessions that are arranged where the parents of both children or both students, the perpetrator and the target, are meeting with administration.
Got it. Okay.
And that's where facilitation sometimes is helpful in terms of having someone there with a mental health background to help that process, or a trained mediator.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Some other things that in terms of dispute resolution options, formal complaints can be filed with the Michigan Department of Education or with a federal agency like the Office of Civil Rights or the Department of Justice. There may be a procedural due process hearing in the context of discipline. There are, due process hearings to allow the student to present witnesses and evidence and to determine what the discipline would be. In the context of special education, a due process hearing is presided over by an administrative law judge, and if the bullying and harassment has been really intense and pervasive and long-lasting and has resulted in the student not being able to have educational benefit, then there might be a denial of an appropriate education, and there could be an administrative law judge addressing that aspect of things. And then, of course, there can be a lawsuit filed in federal or state court.
Okay. Wow. So in these meetings or mediations or whatever it is that they're taking part in, what is it that the parents are likely to be looking for?
Yeah, they may, avail themselves of any of the options we just talked about, but initially they're usually wanting to have a meeting with the principal or whoever's been involved, whoever's been notified with respect to what is going on with their child. And other school personnel might participate in that meeting, including a school social worker, psychologist, or counselor, or teacher. Oftentimes, parents will request that an investigation be done by an administrator and request that they be informed of the outcome of that investigation, and maybe request that they receive a written summary of the steps that will be taken to prevent further bullying.
Mm-hmm.
If those measures don't result in the change that they're hoping for their child, they may involve the superintendent or appear before the Board of Education or request mediation.
Mm-hmm. Are you finding that the schools are getting more sensitive to bullying, that they're being more responsive?
There's certainly a lot more education out there, and we'll be talking a little bit later about the anti-bullying statutes and what they require, but every district has to have policies and procedures, which are very prescribed. The requirements of them are prescribed by the statute, and they're encouraged to have annual staff trainings. I think there's much more awareness, and there's sensitivity training, and there's anti-bullying programs. The issue, again, is that, that 81% of the incidents never being reported and things happening under the radar. It's so imperative that school staff respond quickly, consistently, and effectively. And unfortunately, sometimes you have a situation where a student or a parent might be exaggerating. On the flip side, you might have a school district that's or school personnel that are downplaying or denying that the incidents occur.
Confusing. So they may be asking for an investigation or involvement of the superintendent or the Board of Education. If that doesn't work, what is it that they're asking for beyond that?
Some of the things we talked about before. They may file a complaint with either a state or federal agency. They may request mediation, or they may threaten or actually file a lawsuit. But there are many positive outcomes that can come about as a result of mediation, and it's a really good tool for purposes of addressing bullying and harassment.
So what have you seen? What types of outcomes have you seen come out of mediation?
Well, first of all, you have to pick the players. Typically, the parents are involved, administrators are involved, anyone that has investigated or witnessed the bullying behavior. Involvement of the student is not typical, but there are some instances where maybe the student that is the victim is included. You don't typically have the victim and perpetrator there. Things that can happen are, in terms of outcomes is, you know, they may determine that, you know, a professional development is necessary for staff. They may decide that a student assembly specifically on anti-bullying and the negative impact of bullying and ways to report and to prevent it is an option that should be pursued. There might be parent or student training. There may be school surveys to determine the frequency, type, and location of the bullying behavior. They may institute school-wide bullying prevention programs if they don't already have them. They might institute positive behavioral interventions and supports, and those can be for groups of students or for individual students. There's various tiers of positive behavioral intervention. They might form anti-bullying task force with various stakeholders to take a look at, any surveys or to review programs that are available and to review and select programs or to revise and update anti-bullying policies. They might involve an independent consultant or some community-based organization. Obviously there are times where there's discipline of the perpetrator is indicated. Discipline or some other consequence, whether it be, detention or restitution or, restoration, if there was damage to property, providing a new iPad or whatever it is they might have destroyed. Behavior management plan for the perpetrator, discipline or reprimand of school staff who maybe ignored or contributed to the problem. We talked before about parent conferences with either one set or both sets of parents,
right.
School social work counseling or psychological services for the target or the perpetrator. Any agreed-upon interventions obviously need to be documented in the mediation agreement so it's well understood what the parties agree to do. Some other things that sometimes occur as a result of mediation is they decide that an adult escort is appropriate either for the victim or for the bullier.
Interesting.
So sometimes you have to find a designated support person so that the person who is being bullied knows who to go to and when to go to them and how to do that. Peer-to-peer support, so that you develop supervised peer support groups and peer support during vulnerable times, additional staff supervision in areas where, unstructured times, recess, lunch, hallways. And then separating the target and the bully to avoid placement in the same classes or the same lunch period or having lockers near one another. So sometimes those kinds of things are helpful.
So it's everything from education to discipline to protection, it sounds like.
Absolutely, Zena, you got it.
Okay.
A change of educational placement of the target or bully sometimes occurs, but this option, changing the placement needs to be exercised with caution because it could turn out to be, a potential punishment of the victim or possibly a denial of an appropriate education in the least restrictive environment for the victim. So it's something to consider and sometimes something that parents and students desire. So I don't think you completely ignore that possibility. But again, it's something that you want to think carefully about before, because it's rather drastic, removing a student from their school environment. From their peers.
Is it always the victim that gets moved, or is it ever the bully?
It's the bully sometimes. Yeah.
Oh, it is. Okay. So if they get moved, or is something, what are the options? if it comes to that, and felt that really needs to happen.
Right. And sometimes students need a fresh start. You know, maybe sometimes the perpetrator needs a fresh start, and sometimes the victim needs a fresh start. So sometimes there's school of choice within the district, which at least that keeps the student in the district. So if there's more than one middle school or more than one high school or elementary school, there could be a placement within, or even an administrative transfer. There are certain procedures that have to be followed for school of choice. So if it's a situation where deadlines have passed for school of choice, you know, it's possible to get an administrative transfer to another school within the district. There's also school of choice between districts. And then there are public school academies or charter schools. Students can attend typically the school where a parent is employed. Districts have policies and procedures that will sometimes permit employees to allow their students to attend the school where they work. And then under Michigan, the Michigan statutes, students whose parents are divorced are considered residents of the school district in which either parent resides, regardless of custody. And so that sometimes is very helpful. They don't have to reside, you know, with the father, for example, to attend the school district where the father lives. The father does not
have to have any. Those are all free options, which are probably pretty popular with everybody.
Right. Those are all free options. There are, you know, other options that have cost associated with them. They could pay non-resident tuition to a neighboring district. They could elect to go to private school, either religious or non-denominational. They could decide to participate in Michigan Virtual High School, an online schooling option. They could do homeschooling without online, or, you know, with online. There are career technical centers for high school students. The Post-Secondary Enrollments Option Act, you know, allows students to take a certain number of college courses. And then if a student is homebound or hospitalized because of some physical or mental health condition that's expected to last for a period of time, they could get homebound or hospitalized services in the hospital. And then for special education students, there's county special education programs, there's day treatment centers, and there's residential facilities like therapeutic boarding schools.
So really, it runs the gamut.
There are a number of options, and sometimes it's good to consider those in the context of mediation when you're dealing with a particular situation.
Right. So why don't we take a look at what some of the laws are, both those nationally and Michigan, but maybe other states as well?
Okay, sure. I'm happy to say, it's been over time, but I'm happy to say that 49 states now have anti-bullying laws. And Montana is the only state that does not have a law, but it does have a policy. Michigan was among the last four states to join the party. They were without a statute for a long time, but they had a very strong policy since 2001. So, because they had a strong policy and they were one of the first to adopt a strong state policy, they didn't get legislation until later. So the legislation, Michigan anti-bullying statute, was enacted in 2011. And it's also known as MATS, Safe School Law. And this is in honor of a young man named Matt Epling. He was a Michigan teenager who committed suicide in the summer of 2002 after being bullied and assaulted as part of a hazing welcome to high school. It happened at the last day of his eighth grade, and his father, Kevin Epling, lobbied for legislation for over 6 years before it was enacted in Michigan. So the anti-bullying statutes and policies are so important because they're designed to protect the rights of all students to a safe and secure learning environment. And there's the recognition mm-hmm. that students must feel safe in order to reach their academic potential.
So what does Michigan's law say?
It's pretty, well prescribed. I want to take a few minutes, and there's a lot, and it is in the packet of materials that all of the listeners received, so you'll want to look at it carefully yourselves. But it does contain a definition of bullying. And it defines it as written, verbal, physical, any written, verbal, or physical act, or any electronic communication intended to harm. And then they include that a reasonable person would know was likely to harm, and that it substantially interferes with educational opportunities, benefits, or programs. The definition is longer than that, but I was trying to shorten it to the best, of my ability so that you can mm-hmm. take a look at the statute itself. It broadly defines at school. So school includes the classroom, school premises, school bus, school-sponsored activities or events. And it also explicitly includes telecommunications that are made off of school campus if the telecommunication device or the service provider is owned by or under control of the school.
Interesting.
And yeah. It provides immunity for employees, volunteers, students, and parents who promptly report bullying in good faith. The immunity does not apply to the school official who's designated as responsible for remedying the bullying. Because they need to do their job, what is required in order to investigate and take steps to prevent further bullying. The statute, the Michigan Anti-Bullying Statute, requires every school district, intermediate school district, charter school, et cetera, to develop a policy prohibiting bullying, and they must file a copy of that policy with the Michigan Department of Education. And the policy itself has to include a number of provisions. So they prescribe mm-hmm. in this statute what the policy must include. It has to prohibit bullying. It has to prohibit retaliation against the target, witness, or other person for reporting the bullying. It has to prohibit false accusation. It must state that all students are protected. It must identify the school officials responsible for implementing the anti-bullying policy. The policy also has to state how it will be publicized. Is it going to be on the website, in the student handbooks, at student assemblies, et cetera? It needs to describe a procedure for notifying the parent or guardian of the victim and the parent or guardian of the perpetrator. It has to contain the procedure for reporting bullying, a procedure for prompt investigation, and a procedure for documenting any prohibited incident and what consequences were imposed. So they report to their own Board of Education on an annual basis, are required to report, what has occurred.
So it's quite broad, quite broad.
Yeah, it does include a number of provisions that, is helpful in terms of making sure that the policy is comprehensive. The schools are not required but are encouraged to include provisions for anti-bullying task force and programs for students and parents and annual staff trainings.
Okay.
The statute does not include any legal remedy for violations of it. So there's no private
right. Why was that left out?
There's no private right of action, but there are federal and state statutes that apply that can be used to pursue a private right of action.
Got it.
I think it's pretty significant that the State Board of Ed model policy, they have a model policy that still is referenced and school districts can adopt. Their model policy contains a prohibition against bullying based on sexual orientation and gender identity, even though those are not protected under the federal civil rights or the Michigan statute. And it also addresses the role of the bystander, which I think is key. The bystander, it's so important that they be coached and encouraged and know how to report and know that they shouldn't participate in the bullying and they shouldn't pass on derogatory messages and that they'll be protected if they cooperate in investigations.
Well, that sounds wonderful because my understanding is that the role of the bystander has been really a focus of much research recently around bullying.
That's right, Zena. That's correct.
Right. So that's the Michigan anti-bullying statute. Are there other statutes that are important?
Yes, there are many federal civil rights statutes that are relevant to bullying and harassment. Bullying based on certain characteristics or traits are explicitly protected by the federal civil rights statutes. So you have Title VI that prohibits bullying harassment based on race, color, or national origin. Title IX prohibits harassment based on sex. And the Americans with Disabilities Act and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act prohibit discrimination based on disability. The Office of Civil Rights enforces and investigates claims of violations of Title VI, IX, ADA, and 504. There's also a little less known is Title IV of the Civil Rights Act, which applies specifically to public elementary, secondary schools and public colleges and universities. And Title IV prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, sex, religion, or national origin. And so that's a specific provision for schools. The other provisions, Title VI, IX, and ADA and 504, can apply in other contexts like the employment context and public accommodations and those sorts of things.
So it sounds like bullying actually is considered to be discrimination.
Yeah, it can be discrimination or harassment, yes, if it's based on a protected characteristic. And then the Michigan Civil Rights Statute, the Michigan Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act, when it was originally enacted, it prohibited discrimination on the basis of religion, race, color, or national origin. Later on, they added amendments for sex, age, and then marital status, specifically under the Michigan. Height and weight is under Michigan Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act. Arrest records. So that, you know, is significant from the standpoint of the specifically referencing marital status, height, and weight. And it applies to employers, places of accommodation, and educational institutions. And then there's the Michigan Persons with Disabilities Civil Rights Act, which prohibits harassment and discrimination on the basis of disability.
Are there also cases that are relevant?
Yeah, the U.S. Supreme Court, the landmark cases from the U.S. Supreme Court are the Gebster versus Lago Vista School District. In that case, the Supreme Court held that a school district could be held liable for a teacher's sexual harassment of a student when the district had notice of the harassment and responded in a deliberately indifferent manner. And that same precedent has been applied by the lower courts to other forms of discrimination and harassment based on other things like disability, race, et cetera. In Davis versus Monroe County, which is another U.S. Supreme Court case, seminal case, the Supreme Court found that a school district can be held liable for student-to-student harassment. And the standard's a little bit higher here. Again, there needs to be the notice of the harassment. There has to be deliberate indifference to the harassment. But there's the added nuance that it has to be, when it's peer-to-peer, so severe, pervasive, or objectively offensive that it denies the student equal access to educational opportunities or benefits. So there's that additional
nuance. So there is liability. It's just hard. It's hard to get to that threshold level.
Right. And the Office of Civil Rights, like I said before, they investigate, and they have found violations based on things that are not quite as high a standard. So in other words, they have found when bullying or harassment is ignored, encouraged, tolerated, or not adequately addressed, that there can be liability when the district either has actual knowledge or reasonably should have known about the harassment.
So a little lower level there.
Yes, yes.
Quite a bit lower. Well, could you take some time to talk about some specific cases?
Sure. What I'd like to do is, there was a couple cases that I wanted to just highlight earlier, and I just want to mention one of them, and then I'd like to get into more specific cases that I've been involved in as an example. But another startling case and a very sad situation occurred in August of 2011. It involved a murder-suicide in Maryland. A single mother who happened to be a psychiatrist shot and killed her 13-year-old son and then herself. Her son, who had autism spectrum disorder and was overweight, had been repeatedly teased by his peers, and the mother had been engaged in constant battles with the school system and had, you know, requested but was denied payment for private school placement. So again, another sad example, and obviously it's not, you know, the causation is multifactorial, but certainly this was a huge part of the trigger of that particular situation and incident.
How awful. Wow.
So just to take a few minutes to talk about a case that I was involved in, to give you kind of a flavor of what can happen through mediation. I'm going to give this young man a name. It's not his actual name, but this case involved harassment based on perceived sexual orientation. And it really wasn't clear whether it was actual or perceived, but and that's why I say perceived. Andrew was a high school varsity football player, very good athlete, academically really strong, very well liked by his peers. He happened to be actively involved in the Gay Straight Alliance, which is a club that many schools have. It sponsors educational programs and activities to raise awareness about gay rights. And although Andrew had not identified himself as gay, he was generally regarded as being homosexual. When the football season ended, his former teammates began to harass Andrew about his involvement in this Gay Straight Alliance club. And they started to wait outside of the meetings and confront him after others had left the building. There was no physical aggression, but there were many taunts and verbal threats of assault if he didn't cease his involvement in the club, in the Gay Straight Alliance club. So Andrew did not want to discontinue his involvement. He felt very strongly about it. He was an avid supporter. But he became very concerned about his safety, you know, in light of the threats of physical harm. So at school, he began to constantly look over his shoulder and worry about what was going to happen next. And he became very anxious and unable to concentrate. And as a result, his academic performance suffered. His parents noticed changes in him, but they didn't understand why. and he was too embarrassed and ashamed to tell his parents or anyone about the bullying, so nobody was aware of it. So Andrew decided to take matters in his own hands, and he began to carry a pocket knife in his backpack. He showed it to a few friends, but never had any occasion to use it. And a student who saw the knife reported it to administration. And, of course, the principal immediately called Andrew to his office searched his backpack and found the knife. The principal then called the parents to let them know about the incident and to inform them that Andrew was indefinitely suspended pending further investigation. Of course, the parents were shocked to learn that he had a knife at school and he had never previously been involved in any disciplinary incident. And so in terms of the perspective of the parties at the time of mediation, you know, the student and parent perspective was that Andrew was a model student and athlete. He had never been in trouble in school before. They felt the school should just allow him to return without any kind of consequence for having the weapon at school. They were concerned because final exams were imminent, and they wanted to be sure that he could participate in final exams, and they wanted the bullies to be punished. The school's perspective was that Andrew should be disciplined according to the relevant Michigan statute and district policy. Because the knife blade was over 3 inches, Andrew was subject to the 180 mandatory expulsion under the Michigan mandatory expulsion provisions. And the district in their own code of conduct had a zero tolerance policy regarding weapons. If expelled, Andrew would not be able to attend his school or enter the school property for 180 school days. And if he was expelled under the mandatory expulsion provision applied to dangerous weapons, he would be expelled from all public schools. And if he wanted to return, he would have to petition the Board of Education for reinstatement after 150 school days had elapsed. So it was a high-stakes situation. There was, you know, the bullying and harassment, and then on top of it, there was, a disciplinary concern. And that's often what happens, in mediation, that there are a number of things that intersect with respect to issues at school. At mediation, my job was to get everybody to acknowledge certain things, and for feelings to be validated and for apologies to happen and things of that sort to happen first before being able to move on. So the school representatives acknowledged, from their knowledge of Andrew and their review of his educational file, he was a good student, great athlete, and he'd never been in trouble before. So that there was that acknowledgement. The parents acknowledged that Andrew really should have sought assistance and that they did not at all condone him taking a knife to school, and he had been disciplined at home for it, and a lot of privileges had been taken away. And then, of course, as you do in mediation, you look at common interest, and the common interest of the parties included, school safety and prevention of bullying. The parents also came prepared with letters from clergy and Boy Scout leaders vouching for Andrew's character. The administration came prepared with a photograph of the knife with a ruler reference. We thought, and the parents had taken pictures of the knife as well. We didn't think we needed to have the knife there in the session, but as we were looking at some of the photographs, we realized that the knife was awfully close to the 3-inch mark. And the statute the mandatory expulsion statute actually requires that the blade be longer than 3 inches. And frankly, I think the school district, really the administration, knowing that he was a good kid and that there hadn't been any altercation or anything of that sort with the knife, that it was purely carrying it, I think they were looking for a way to get around the mandatory expulsion. Mm-hmm. And The school agreed not to involve the police because certainly they could have. And ultimately, the administration agreed to impose a suspension of 15 school days rather than 180. And this took, you know, obviously some discussions with superintendents and others to get this permission. And the principal agreed to count time that he had already served, snow days, and he also agreed to count examination days toward the 15-day suspension so that the student was able to take his exams, but it was administered in a separate setting individually as opposed to on school campus. And then the principal also, of course, agreed to investigate the bullying incidents and inform the parents of the findings and then issue appropriate discipline. And upon Andrew's report, the principal and social worker would meet with him to debrief and ease his transition back to school and then would also provide him with the option, if he chose, to have a facilitated meeting because some of these perpetrators were former friends. And so that was something that would have to be done with his consent and, of course, his parents' consent as well. And then the district agreed to release the district from any kind of civil rights claims or damages.
Mm-hmm. Very comprehensive. So are there other cases? We have a little bit of time. Are there other cases that you want to talk about?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I can describe another case, and then perhaps what we can do is open the lines for people to make comments or ask questions. Another situation involved racial discrimination and bullying, and it involved a student that I'm going to call Louie, who was a very bright middle school student who's African-American. He attended a suburban middle school under school choice, and at that middle school, the students and faculty were predominantly Caucasian, and there were very few minority students. Louis happened to be of short stature and wore very thick glasses. Shortly after he came to school, a group of Caucasian students, led by the basketball team captain, started to taunt and bully him. In the hallways, they pushed and shoved him in his locker. They played catch with his backpack. Louis would try to fight back but was unsuccessful in stopping the bullying. And the harassment just kept escalating. The boys began using racial slurs and tripping him in the lunchroom when no staff was nearby. Initially, Louis didn't tell anyone. He wanted to try to handle it on his own. But around Halloween time, the bullying was so frequent and intense that he started to tell his parents he didn't want to go to school and that he'd rather go back to his old school. And his mother was really concerned because it was so uncharacteristic of him because Louis always loved school and, you know, excelled in school. And so when his parents pressed him, Louis admitted that he had been bullied. His parents met with the principal and, you know, asked that something be done and that be investigated completely and fully and that discipline be imposed on the perpetrators. And what occurred after the investigation is that the principal reprimanded the boys and imposed detention. And for a while, things actually got better. But and even, you know, after Christmas break, the captain of the basketball team befriended Louis, and he started to ask Louis to hang out with him and the other members of the basketball team, and he started to ask for Louis's help in math because Louis was really, you know, a very bright student, and Louis was really relieved, and he started to do anything that this other young man asked of him. And so he started to have Louis do his math homework and started to make Louis clean up after him in the cafeteria and pick up his towels in the locker room. And soon, you know, other teammates of the captain were also demanding that Louis carry their belongings, and they began calling him Blackie, saying it was an affectionate term. So ultimately, another student, a bystander, observed their behavior in the locker room and fortunately reported it to the principal. The principal informed the parents, who were understandably very upset and angry, and the school suggested mediation. So at the time going into mediation, the student and parent perspective was, first of all, they didn't want Louis to participate in the mediation. They didn't think that that would be helpful. And Louis really had some hesitation about his parents participating. He was asking his parents not to rock the boat because things were better than they had been. But the school, the parents felt that the school should, you know, expel the perpetrators or kick them off the basketball team. That was their feeling. And they also felt like the school should pay for an expensive, prestigious private school. And they were threatening to file for civil rights claims for damages. The school's perspective was that the perpetrators would be disciplined according to the student handbook, and they suggested that an escort be provided for Louis during unstructured times, especially in the hallways, the cafeteria, locker room, you know, that kind of thing. And they offered to hold a student assembly to review the anti-bullying policy. When the parties were not able to resolve the matter on their own and came to mediation, again, you know, we dealt with the emotions. You know, the parents' outrage and anger was validated. You know, principal agreed to and fully investigate and to issue written findings and provide that to the parents to address the common interest and concern of school safety and dignity. The school agreed to hire an independent consultant to create a school-wide bullying prevention program and to conduct diversity sensitivity and awareness training. The school also agreed to have this independent consultant help to revise the anti-bullying policy to address all forms of bullying and to encourage reporting and full and prompt investigation along with the written findings. It was agreed that the perpetrators would serve detention every Saturday for a month and that they would attend a racial awareness program. Ultimately, the parties agreed that Louis would return to school, and they did not want an escort for Louis because they didn't want him singled out more, but it was agreed that administrative and faculty supervision would be increased in the unstructured areas with a careful eye on Louis and the other students. The school social worker would meet with Louis to coach him on assertiveness strategies and bullying prevention, you know, techniques. And the parents agreed to release the district for claims, any claims of damages.
Wow. Well, thank you for outlining those two cases. And it sounds like it's time now for questions and comments from participants. Bob, are you going to lead that?
Sure will. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, just press *6 on your phone, state your name, your question, and then please press *6 again to eliminate background noise. So, *6,
hello.
Name, question.
Hello. This is Mark McWilliams. Yeah, hi, it's Mark McWilliams. My question for Laura is, you spoke at the beginning of your presentation, Laura, about how the school had to show that there was a nexus to the school environment in order for them to be involved in some of these things. Is there any kind of guidance on just how far that goes as far as both time and place?
Thanks, Mark. And by the way, Mark McWilliams is from Michigan Protection and Advocacy, and he handles a number of these cases himself. So, and is very experienced. You're speaking, Mark, of the, as I'm understanding the question, you're speaking of the nexus between the cyberbullying behavior and the school impact. I want to make sure I understand your question correctly.
That's one example. But in general, I mean, we've seen cases, for example, where there's bullying behavior takes place, you know, across the street from the school, after school hours, people's houses, in addition to the cyberbullying. I'm just wondering if there's any kind of limitation or guidance on how far that goes.
Mm-hmm. Well, there certainly has to be some impact on the school environment, you know, and the order and discipline within the school environment. I mean, it is difficult, you know, to establish sometimes, especially when it's off-campus behavior or if it's behavior where they're using website providers that have nothing to do with the school. But what oftentimes will happen is that it trickles over. And so, you know, you have a situation where it converts from Facebook to some other site that is used by the school generally, and so there you have a more direct nexus. And some of this, you know, is recorded, you know, by using these different devices. You have to sometimes trace it through either the telephone company or the internet service provider. So I think, you know, in terms of the school district, I would say they'd probably want to err on the side of addressing something rather than saying, gee, the nexus is just not close enough or to the school environment.
If it's discussed in school, does that provide the nexus if people are talking about it once they get back to school?
I think if it disrupts the school environment, if they're talking about it in a class and the teacher, you know, they're so preoccupied with it that the teacher's unable to, you know, teach the class, then I would think that, you know, that certainly imposes an impact on the educational process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
This is John Brower. Question.
Hi, John.
Hi, Laura. When you talk about the mediation, I mean, there obviously are a number of players or parties involved. You have the victim. You have the school people that have their role, and I would think legally want to avoid any claim they were deliberately indifferent because that opens some liability to them. But you also have the bully and the bully's parents. Do you see them getting involved in it, or is this just between the victim and the school? And I'll turn on my muting.
It's a really good question, John. And John is another education law attorney that has lots of experience in this area. I think that really the participants in any mediation are always very, very carefully selected. And having the both sets of parents or the victim and the perpetrator there, that's a tough situation because even though there's protections with a professional mediator, you still run the same risk we talked about when there's peer mediation, you know, in terms of possible intimidation, fear, potential for abuse. So it's a discussion that really has to take place. It may be a situation, too, where you utilize, instead of joint sessions, separate sessions where there's kind of the caucusing and the shuttle diplomacy between the two groups of people.
This is Larry Schneider. Can you hear me?
Yes, Larry.
I'm the president of the Mid-Michigan Dispute Resolution Center, and we use restorative justice very, very effectively in the schools. I haven't heard that term used at all in the past hour and a half. Wondered what your thoughts are.
I would love to hear more from you, Larry, about restorative justice, because I think that it is an important means of dispute resolution. And it's interesting that you say that, because I'm looking back at my notes and I thought, oh, yeah, restitution or restorative justice, but I didn't say it. You're right. So if you wouldn't mind taking a couple minutes to talk about how you approach that and what your results have been, that would be great.
Certainly. First of all, I think a lot of people feel that the notion of bullying the bully just hasn't worked over time. In other words, sending a kid home for 20 days and excusing him from school generally doesn't solve anything. It just allows the kid to sit at the computer and engage in more cyberbullying. But the restorative justice process that we use in the Lansing and some of the other schools that sponsor it involves all of the stakeholders getting together with a facilitated mediator who's skilled in restorative justice, and they, in essence, try to get to the bottom of the problem. And a lot of times the problems might go back to something that happened in second grade. One of the examples I remember was a fierce bullying situation that was going on in high school, and when they sat the kids down, it all stemmed back to something that one of the kids had said to the other kid when they were in seventh grade about him being a faggot. And the kid didn't realize he'd said it and apologized. And under our restorative justice model, the parents participate, the students participate, the affected teachers participate. And ideally, an agreement is signed by all involved parties. And I don't think we've had an agreement violated, at least in the time that I've been on the board. So it's not without its critics, because there are some people that think that you've got to punish everybody who does anything wrong in school. But getting to the bottom of the dispute often and then resolving it through a mutual agreement and having the kids come to their own understanding of what's going on and what will make things right is a lot more effective, we found, than just sending somebody home for 10 days or 20 days.
Thank you, Larry. We appreciate that input, and makes a lot of sense.
Next question or comment.
Just wanted to make a comment and thank Laura for the excellent presentation and Zena for being a great facilitator. Really an excellent seminar, excellent materials.
Thank you, Nick.
Wonderful. And for those of you who, I've hopefully everybody received the materials link, but just in case, the materials are located at www.mishbar, that's mishbar.org/adr/materials.cf, as in Frank, M as in Mary. Any other comments or questions before we conclude the seminar? Apparently not. So thank you, Laura. Thank you, Zena. It was a pleasure working with both of you today. Excellent materials, excellent presentation, and you brought it in under an hour and a half. So congratulations.
Thanks, Bob.
And thanks, Bob, for all the technical help.
Moderating. I certainly have tons of other examples, but I think it's time to say goodbye to everyone, and feel free to call me or email me if you want to talk further.
All right, we'll conclude the call now. Thank you all.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.